Welcome to the Beer Healer Interviews. I am your host, Chris Lukianenko, and I scour this big brand land of ours, looking under fermenters and behind mash tuns to find the best beer stories to share with you. The Beer Healer Interviews is now available on all major podcast services. If you like the show and want to help out, can I ask you to simply rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast service? Just leave a few words and a rating and the podcast gods will do the rest. By doing this, you'll help others to discover the show more easily and hopefully get more people interested in this great industry that we call craft beer. Today on the podcast, I'm doing my bit to keep local alive during these shitty times. In case you weren't aware, the beer being brewed in Tasmania is bloody good. It's no longer an island described as having two breweries. The big old monoliths are still operating, but the number of small craft breweries has been increasing in recent years. I think at last count we were sitting around 40 breweries in Tasman. My guest today is Cornel Jankulovic. You may have heard him on an earlier episode of the podcast when we were talking about collaboration beers with fellow Hobart brewers. He started his brewery about 4 or so years ago in an old small goods warehouse in Hobart's busy restaurant district just north of the city centre. Shambles Brewery was established by 4 mates with various skill sets that worked together, kind of like Voltron, to ensure they brewed great beer, operated a great venue, and were able to pay the bills. So to tell us more about where they came from and what they're up to now, welcome back to the Beer Healer Interviews, Cornel Jankulovic.
G'day.
How good am I with pronouncing the surname, eh?
Very good. Very good.
All right?
Almost, like you've got a, foreign surname yourself.
Well, yeah, there you go. You get used to it. I must admit, when I saw it the first time, I had no idea. It doesn't spell like it sounds, like my beautiful name.
No, it certainly doesn't, no.
Well, mate, welcome back to your very own feature episode. Some might call this a mic drop moment for you and say that you've made it in this game when you've been on the Beer Healer Interviews.
Especially twice. I mean, that's, thank you for having me. I feel, yeah.
Some may not say that. Hold on. I don't know if you've got a beer, but I have. Hold on. There we go.
You know, it's no step brewers, but, you know, it's something. No,
true, true. Shout out to Clint and the boys.
Yeah, they, as if they need bigger heads right now.
Dear, no, they're doing a great job.
They are doing a great job.
Now, mate, you are well known for producing great beer in your hometown, but there's going to be a few people listening to this podcast that pretty much know nothing about you. So I want to take it back to the beginning, which I know is a few years ago now, but I think it's a good story. By day, you're a science teacher, and by night, you're a mad keen home brewer. At what point did you want to throw away your hard-earned teaching career and take a chance on brewing professionally?
Yeah, it's a sort of funny one. When you kind of think back and summarize it like that, it does seem a little bit crazy.
Yep.
But, yeah, and especially, you know, sort of, I guess, timing-wise and, you know, how it all sort of came about, I guess, it is a bit strange. But, no, I've sort of been homebrewing since I was back at uni, studying my science degree. Just, you know, kit brewing with mates, uni student mates, when you kind of, you know, discover that homebrew kit and you suddenly think, oh, wow, this is a great way to make cheap beer at home.
Famous last words.
Yeah, and then you spend a couple of years brewing really shit beer out of a can, you know, with plastic buckets essentially and old crappy dead yeast. And you can, you know, you sort of convince yourself with each swallow, yeah, this tastes really good. It's almost as good as the commercial stuff. But really it's, you know, just cheap. And that's what, you know, kind of gets you going. But, no, I think out of my group of mates, we all sort of, bought each other for our birthdays in one particular year. We each got, you know, one of our mates, a homebrew kit. So we became like a brew crew and we would get together on the weekends every now and again.
Did you give yourselves a name?
Don't think so. I think just brew crew, which is pretty boring. But we just kind of got together and, you know, we'd kind of all, coincidentally brew beer at the same time. When I say brew, you know, we used to basically heat up a tin of syrup and pour it in some hot water and then chill it down and, you know, pitch some yeast and away we go. But yeah, it was more just an excuse to get together with mates and drink really. But I think a couple of us, me and one other mate out of that group, we were the only ones that were kind of a bit annoyed that the beer wasn't as good as it, you know, should be. And we were the ones that sort of, you know, as everyone else sort of dropped off and eventually, you know, later in uni, people graduated and got real jobs and could afford to drink actual beer, stopped bothering. And but the two of us sort of kept going and started to research a little bit more and read more about it and teach ourselves, you know, kind of how to make better beer from a kit. And then the turning point for me was a book called How to Brew by John Palmer, which is a pretty well-known home brewing book. It's definitely my favorite one, and it kind of changed my perspective on home brewing. Suddenly I could kind of see all the science in it, and that really appealed to me. So, the two of us took it from there and, you know, got better equipment, and we moved to brewing a bag and, you know, then, milling our own grain and pitching our own hops and boiling and basically replicating the commercial process. And, it was one of those things, one of those sort of slow journeys over the years. You kind of, you know, you learn more, you get better at it. You realize that, you kind of learn what to do about the mistakes you've made, and you realize that it takes kind of good equipment, to improve a lot of things in your brewing process. So
was there an epiphany moment where you said, righto, I think I'm good enough to do this properly?
We were making beer on fairly cobbled together equipment, but it was full all grain brewing. So we were sort of using old copper, laundry tubs with heating elements in the bottom and stuff for our mash tun and the kettle. And we were doing the full kind of process, no different to what I'm doing now. And we were managing to churn out beers that were good enough that our mates were kind of going, this is good. This tastes like a, you know, commercial craft beer. And they started to ask us if they could buy beer off us. So that was sort of a turning point when our mates actually stopped, you know, kind of going from
wanting just to get the freebies.
Yeah. And also stopped going from kind of tasting it, and you could sort of see on their face that they were, you know, it's really good. But, you know, they really meant was it's look for a home brew. It's good. And went from, you know, saying from for a homebrew it's good to this is really good, can we buy it? That was a turning point. And at that point, the two of us kind of went, yeah, the gear's holding us back. We need more gear. So we bought, the two of us pitched in and basically turned his shed into a brewery. And we ordered our own custom designed stainless steel 3-vessel brew house from China. And basically created a, you know, 100-liter nano brewery in his shed. But, you know, it was probably more sophisticated than the brewery I've got now, to be honest. It was more computer controlled, and there was a lot more automation in it.
Yeah.
And we had a lab and stuff, you know, sort of a cobbled together lab.
Jesus, you were serious.
Yeah, we were. Like, we really, really, really loved it as a hobby. And I think at that point we both kind of realized, this is probably getting a bit too serious. So I think at that point when we sort of did that, we both knew that we weren't going to be spending that kind of money just to make beer on the weekends, that it was kind of a stepping stone. And if we could churn out some good beer on that, then perhaps we could one day take it to the next level.
And you eventually both went together to do that, the two of you?
Not quite. We would have loved to. He had a bit of a sort of sad situation at home. His wife, you know, high school sweetheart, one of you know, my good friends as well. Like, we all kind of knew each other from high school. She was diagnosed with MND, motor neurone disease, a few years before. So, yeah, basically he was her full-time care at home, and this was sort of something we did together at his place, because it was something that, you know, he sort of could do when it was at his place in his shed.
Yep.
So it was sort of a great bonding experience with us too. But, unfortunately he couldn't really, go elsewhere to work without sort of getting her a full-time care, and he didn't want to do that, and that was totally, you know, that was never really on the cards. It was sort of more the dream at the time was actually to possibly just build a brewery on his property. He had a fairly big block out at Old Beach.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. And we thought maybe we'll just build it here, and that way we can both work here and work together and just, you know, keep making it bigger.
Yep.
But it didn't quite work out that way. So, we he's, you know, he's still sort of part of the brewery from a bit of a distance, and he's still one of my best mates. But he hasn't actually work at the brewery, and we didn't sort of just start it together like we were sort of planning to at the time.
Yeah. And so what happened? One day you found some like-minded individuals, or you got some people approached you, or what was the next step?
Well, as we were sort of doing this, you know, kind of making these, and we were, you know, we had 200 litre fermenters. So we were making, you know, every batch we did, we had a 50 litre brewery with 100 litre fermenters. So we'd do double batches into these fermenters, and basically we'd get a couple of kegs out of each of them. So we were actually kegging all of our beer and then bottling, counter pressure bottling from kegs. So we already had beer in kegs before we bottled it.
Yep.
And we sort of started to toy with the idea of, you know, a way to test the waters would be to see if anyone would buy one of these kegs. So started sort of having chats to, you know, Chris at the Winston and a good mate from uni, Jezza, who used to run the Republic Bar.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
And he's now running Hanging Gardens. Well, it's paused, but he was running Hanging Gardens.
Yeah.
Started to chat to those people and sort of say, look, you know, here's a sample bottle. Would you consider buying a keg? And how often would you, you know, want kegs? And they liked the beer, but it was sort of like, you know, if we have a beer that's selling, you're going to need to give us like 6 kegs a week. And we're like, oh, shit, that's never going to work. You know, so we'd have to be brewing, you know, we were brewing pretty much every weekend as a hobby while still, you know, I still had a full-time job.
Holding down a real job, yeah.
So it was just never going to happen. We were never going to be able to sort of tick away a keg here and a keg there. And that's when we sort of realized that you really had to have something decent size to be able to make money out of it or do it for a living. But the thing that sort of kicked me on was that Jezza was really, really keen, and he talked to the his bosses, the people that ran the Republic, and you know, sort of showed them the beer, and they were sort of half interested in potentially having a little, you know, mini brewery, microbrewery built upstairs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we started sort of a discussion about whether that might work and how, you know, whether we could kind of partner with them and build a whole new brewery at the Republic. And I think that's when things got really serious, because that's when it suddenly became a reality outside of my peer group. It was someone in a professional setting, and a group of people, you know, who owned a successful bar, essentially saying, "Yeah, we might actually trust you to, you know, build a facility." And I'm like, "Shit, well, that's actually quite serious."
maybe I'm pretty good at this stuff after all.
Maybe, and you know, also sort of by then I'd made friends with Scott from Hobart Brewing. He was working at Moo Brew at the time, and I'd gone out there for a day because I went to uni. OJ and I, Owen Johnson, who used to be the head brewer of Moo Brew at the time, and he's now working his sales for HPA, Hot Products Australia.
Yep,
he was the head brewer at Moo Brew, and I asked him, you know, when we were sort of we'd built this pilot brewery in my mate's shed, and we spent, you know, we'd had a probably about a year of brewing on it, and we were, you know, across it, and we were brewing what we thought was pretty good beer. And I thought the only way to really know is to stop asking your friends and actually ask a professional. So I went out to Moo Brew for a day, and OJ was gracious enough to let me hang around. And I met Dave McGill, who was the new head brewer, legend of a bloke.
Yeah, great bloke.
And he was doing the first brew of the morning. OJ kind of gave me a bit of a tour and then left me with the brewers. And I'd brought some of our samples along. And then halfway through the day for the second brew, you know, some old American dude shows up. And I'm like, you know, whose dad is this? It turned out to be Scott, you know, who'd been brewing there for a while. And we hit it off straight away because, you know, he's a great bloke. And he was so, just so interesting. He had a really interesting background. And, you know, he had this whole perspective because he'd come from the American brewing scene, which, of course, we all put up on a massive pedestal down here. As something we want to emulate in Australia.
Yeah.
And we hit it off, and we sort of chatted about, you know, the pilot brewery, and I showed him some of the beers we'd made, and he was really, you know, these are great beers, really great quality. I still homebrew at home, even though I've got, you know, brew for a day job. I get to brew my big American IPAs, which, you know, aren't part of the Moo Brew core. And I said, oh, you should come and, you know, come and hang out and brew a beer with us. And he was like, yeah, absolutely. So he came out and brewed a huge double IPA. That was the first double IPA we'd ever brewed, which is a clone of a famous beer in America called Pliny the Elder. It's like sort of
light beer. Yeah,
the first double IPA ever conceived. And we brewed a clone of that together on our, you know, little pilot brewery, and we loved it, and it was just such an amazing beer. Like, I don't know if there's anything like the original, and didn't really care. It was just so much flavor, and yeah, it's great.
Nice. Yeah.
And we hit it off from there, and so I sort of suddenly had professional brewing friends, which was great because I had someone who knew what they were talking about in a professional scale and could give us some genuine feedback and say, you know, this is good, this isn't good, these are the things you need to work on, these are the things you need to tweak. And simultaneously had these people at a bar kind of saying, hey, what about building a pilot brewery?
Yeah, yeah.
So that kind of gave me the incentive to, right, now I need to write a business plan. I need to.
Oh, I love hearing you say that. I love hearing you say that because often you talk to people, then, you know, they want to, they have to eventually do it themselves, but often that is not the first thought in people's minds when they're starting to brew, that, oh shit, I've got to do all the crappy business plan stuff. I just want to brew beer because I fucking love it.
That's right. And that side of things, the, you know, the kind of business side, it's so important, and it's really, really easy to, especially at the time when things sort of skyrocketed from just home brewing as a hobby to, holy shit, I might want to do this for a living.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm now mates with professional brewers and got people interested in, you know, potentially helping me to make this a career. It's really easy to get caught up in that and to kind of go, let's just do it. Whatever it takes, do it. But, you know, luckily my wife is very sensible and sort of said, you know, there's no way we're throwing our money at something that's a whole new career without actually doing a bit of research. You know, you really need to put some numbers behind this, which I already knew, but it was
good on her. Yeah.
It was, she was sort of very much, you know, you really need to kind of put this on, you know, put some numbers together and actually analyze it, you know, completely take all the emotion out of it and actually look at how you would do it, you know, what scale, how much money it's going to take, how much you realistically think you can sell, and you know, what you can charge, and whether or not there's actually any profit left there. So that process took me about a year, I think, and that was my last year of teaching. Like, throughout that year, the writing was on the wall. I could, you know, I was spending all of my spare time writing this business plan.
Nice. And when you were writing the business plan, did you always in your mind have the brew pub model as the model you want to follow, or did you maybe at some stage think, I want to go more for like a production brewery?
No, it was always brew pub. From the outset, I mean, the business plan started with, I should put something on paper for these people at the Republic to see whether or not it could work there. And the process of doing that, you know, it was sort of like my whole one of the big sort of what do you call them epiphany kind of beer, you know, beer epiphany moments was a trip to WA with my, you know, future wife at the time, and this friend of mine, who was my brew buddy, and his wife at the time, she was in the early stages of her MND, and we were taking the brew pretty seriously then, but we hadn't bought our new pilot brewery yet. But we went to WA, together on a little trip, and, you know, we hit up a couple of breweries and we went to Feral and stuff. But I remember walking into Little Creatures in Fremantle. Oh,
how good is it?
And just being just awed at how amazing this, you know, a massive, you know, brewery behind a big glass wall with, you know, great wood-fired pizzas and serving tanks behind the bar and drinking at the source and that whole thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were both sort of looking at that going, how awesome would this be in Hobart? How great would this work, you know, somewhere down on the waterfront? Or something like that. And wouldn't it be amazing, you know, to do something like this in, you know, Princess Wharf One or something? you know, just stupid dreams. We were nowhere near that at the time. But from then I was kind of like, the brew pub's the way to go. Like it's just such a, it's such a destination. It's such an adventure. It's, you know, connecting with the actual people making the product, all of the stuff that goes with that.
Yeah.
But also from a business perspective, it's selling direct retail to your customers. You know, you're not selling wholesale prices. It's, you know, you get the full retail margin, which is so super important when you're a small brewery.
Absolutely.
So, the whole business plan, you know, the sort of the one that was potentially, it started out as potentially could you put a little 300 to 500 litre brewery upstairs at the Republic. Within a month, I was like, nah, like that's not going to work.
Brew pub.
Yeah, like it just wasn't going to work up there for a whole number of reasons. But the main one was I kind of, in running the numbers and creating this monstrous spreadsheet with, you know, about 50 tabs, and God, I love Excel, like probably, I don't know if I'd say more than Klimt. I think Klimt is probably loves it even more than I do, but yeah, I just love a good spreadsheet. So this thing grew from, you know, just a few, kind of a few jotted down ideas to this massive interlinked thing where I could kind of change, change the scale of the brew house on the front and it would flow through to everything else and be connected to, you know, the profit and loss statement, and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, pretty much the number that made it worth bothering was around about 1,000 litres, you know, that sort of 10 to 12 hectolitre size. There's no way that would have fit at the Republic, but also the whole thing of like, well, if I did
carrying
do that
shit upstairs all the time.
Oh yeah. But if I did do that, you know, how would that work? Like they own the building and would I just be an employee? Would it really be mine? Like how would that work? So I very quickly kind of went to, nah, I'm going to start this from scratch again and pretend there is no location and say, what would I do if I just rethought this with no other parameters other than I want to make a brew pub in Hobart? And so sort of reapproached it from that perspective and went, yep, it's got to be this size minimum. Bigger would be better, but, you know, obviously the cost goes up. Would have to be within these sort of suburbs. And, yeah, just sort of built it from there.
And was the old, what's the Mundy and Sons warehouse where you are?
Yep.
Was that always your first pick or did you have other sites you looked at as well?
Oh, no. We are just so amazingly lucky. A lot of this story is luck really, but
your own luck, mate, I reckon.
the next sort of part of the story was by the time I'd written that business plan towards the end of that year, I knew I wanted to do this and I'd started showing it to, you know, my brew buddy and my other sort of close mates, particularly the ones who sort of I had a lot of respect for in terms of their sort of financial knowledge and their sort of business nous, and very quickly got good feedback from those people who were interested saying that they wanted to be part of it. So they wanted to invest. And they, you know, like it sort of grew fairly quickly. Once I had the business plan out there, a lot of people were saying, we want to be part of this. We want to invest. And so we sort of got to a point of, right, well, we've got, you know, through connections and through friends of friends and all that kind of stuff, we got to a point where we actually had, you know, the investment or close to it. So suddenly it was happening and, you know, started the company, took a year off work, leave without pay.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Just sort of thinking, look, this might still not happen. But I've got long service leave, take leave without pay after that for the rest of the year, try and build it. And if it works, it works. And if not, I'll just come back with my tail between my legs and stick to the day. And so sort of by about February of that year, which was 2015, we were like ready to go. It was like, right, final location, let's build this thing. I had a really good friend who's, you know, one of the business partners, who's our architect, and he came along to every site that we found that was potential and, you know, sort of walked through with me. We talked through the pros and cons and, it took us from that day where I was really excited, right, we've got the investment, we've got the people, we've got everything we need, let's order the equipment. We'd actually ordered our equipment from DME and paid our deposit. And it took us 5 or 6 months before we finally found a location. In that time, we'd found three places that we were sure would be it that all fell through. So that was the hardest part of the whole thing. Like the business plan was difficult, but it was positive. Finding the investment was difficult, but, you know, it was a positive thing. You're kind of getting people on board. But once you've got everything you need and you're trying to just put it somewhere, that was horrendous. So we had, you know, first place we found, had some issues, but it was great, half decent location, had a landlord that just didn't really want to play ball, you know, didn't really care about what went in there, was just sort of interested in getting this minimum amount of rent, didn't want to do any rent free. It was that whole thing. It was like, well, this is going to take us months and months to build. We can't afford to just use up all our investment on rent before we've even started it.
Yep.
So that fell through. And we found, I think, yeah, two other places that we thought we were so close and they fell through. And we got to like, I think it was a pretty close to August of that year. We still hadn't found a place. And I was seriously starting to think, holy crap, this is going to fail just because we've got nowhere to put it. And now we're going to have to just.
And you're due back at work in a couple of months.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, we sort of at that point, and that was the only point in the whole process where we sort of met as a group and I went, look, maybe we have to rethink this and become a production brewery, you know, because there's plenty of warehouses further out, plenty of places, heaps of places, great industrial places in Moona or, you know, Cambridge or heaps of places where you could put a brewery, just nowhere where you could put a good brew pub. And we got really close to making that call. And then just luck as luck would have it, one publican that I'd been talking to said, oh, I'm actually, you know, renting this the front half of this little space and there's a big warehouse out the back and I don't need the front space anymore. I'll introduce you to the landlord. And he introduced me to the Mundys. And they were just golden. They were just the best people, like so interested in what we were doing, so keen to have someone in there to, you know, transform the space. They were exactly what we were looking for, people who actually cared about what we were doing and who actively wanted us there. And we just kind of lucked into it and, you know, great location, so close to the city, right next to, you know, right near sort of North Hobart.
Yeah, yep, nice.
Sort of not quite North Hobart.
Close enough.
Well, it's kind of got a life of its own because after we sort of built something a bit different in that area, a whole bunch of other little cool businesses started popping up in that strip. And so it's now got its own name. You know, people are calling that area Midtown because it's
they don't call it Midtown. don't say that. Don't call it NoHo or so.
No, they really do. I still pretend.
No, thank you.
It's become a bit of a movement that this whole sort of connecting that North Hobart strip with the city and
the university stuff sort of popping up in and around just below it. And
that's right. Yeah. So it's all kind of changing. I mean, the whole city's changed in the last 5-10 years, thanks to Mona. But, we were very, very lucky to end up where we ended up. And, you know, looking back, it's just, I couldn't have imagined a better spot. So,
yeah. And so you put the brew pub model together, opened your doors, and everything was successful.
Obviously, it's not quite that simple. Like, there's a lot of work involved, and there's certainly a lot of mistakes and a lot of learning as you go kind of stuff that happens, you know. Yep. But to some extent, that really is as simple as it is. Like, we opened our doors. We were scared shitless that it wouldn't work. And, you know, we sort of had our soft launch with our friends and family, and that was great. And they came and loved it. And the very next night we opened to the public and thought, what if no one turns up? What if no one comes here? What if no one gives a shit? What if they hate the beers? You know, we only started with sort of four original beers, first four attempts at learning how to brew on a, giant, unfamiliar piece of equipment. And
what were those first four beers?
Oof, this is sort of the thing, like shamefully, my business plan had one gigantic thing in it that turned out to be a complete lie. I had naively thought at the time that this whole home brewing thing was what was popular. You know, everyone wants something new. All of the bars I go to, you know, Winston, they're always rotating taps, always wanting new beers. And all the beer geeks, what we seek out is something new. You know, something gets old hat pretty quick and we stop bothering with it.
There's a lot of other people that love craft beer that aren't necessarily a beer geek though, isn't there?
That's right. But I naively kind of thought that craft beer was all about that. So my business plan revolved around, you know what, we're not going to have core range. We're just going to chuck all that out and we're going to brew different beers all the time. We're constant, like every tap will be rotating.
Yep.
And that way we'll keep ourselves relevant and interesting. And, and if two beers end up being the same, so be it. But really, deep down, we'll be known for just creating new beers all the time. So the first four beers could be whatever they wanted and it didn't really matter if they weren't perfect because – and when I mean perfect in my mind compared to the recipe I'd imagined because no one else would know what they were meant to be. And as long as they were quality beers, they were great. And that way we could brew something different every time. So the first four beers the very first beer we put down was meant to be a session IPA. So I thought I'll start where my heart lies, which is in hoppy beers, but I want something approachable. So I won't go for an IPA to start with. I'll go with something in between. So, you know, something really hoppy, really kind of modern, but, you know, 4.5% sort of lowish in alcohol. And the guy that helped install our brewery, you know, came back, the sort of the consultant dude that worked for DME, came back and you know, sort of commissioned it with me. So he did the first brew with me. And he was sort of taking me through how it all works. And he accidentally added way, like he left a valve open. And so after we'd mashed in this beer that was supposed to sort of finish at you know, specific gravity of about 10-ish, you know, sort of fairly full-bodied, you know, 5%-ish kind of pale ale with lots of hops.
Yep.
He accidentally left a valve open after we'd mashed in while he was rinsing some other tank and added an extra like 300 or 400 litres of water to the mash and it was cold water. So the mash temp dropped. So suddenly it was mashing really, really dry. And then that affected the sparge. So the sparge was like, we just lost like about 6 or 7 points of gravity. So it ended up really low gravity in the kettle. You know, it had mashed too low. So it was going to finish too dry. Like I'm just doing this beer going, this beer's fucked. We're going to have to chuck it out. but obviously it's a learning experience. So we didn't want to, you know, we weren't going to call it at that point. We're like, we'll just see it through and we'll make sure everything's working. We'll just treat this as like wasted ingredients. So I dropped the hopping rate, you know, because it was going to be lower gravity, it was going to be lower alcohol. It couldn't support that much bitterness. So, you know, dropped the hopping rate in the kettle so it wasn't so bitter. Cut the dry hop down so it wasn't so over the top and we weren't wasting hops. And then, yeah, sort of tasted like, it's actually a really easy drinking beer. It's not, nothing wrong with it. It's not bad in any way, shape or form. It's just not the beer I'd intended to brew. And then once it sort of finished fermentation and we, you know, decided, well, do we chuck it? No, we'll transfer it and carbonate it. Let's test that process too. So, you know, got it to the bright tank, carbonate it, tasting it, and everyone's going, this is really delicious. What is it? And I'm like, I don't know. know what it is. It's just a beer. Like it's just a really, and it finished at like 4.3%, nice citrusy, hoppy, kind of easy drinking kind of beer.
And that's what I'm drinking right now, is it?
That's it. And it ended, and I'm going, not knowing to call it. So we just call it a summer ale because that's a bullshit style that doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
It's what you call a beer when you want people to, you know, kind of drink it in summer.
Yeah.
So we just called it a summer ale and released it. And again, this whole thing in my head of it doesn't actually matter that it fucked up. It'll be out there for a few weeks, then it'll be gone and we'll have something new on tap. So brewed that, then went to an amber ale, then brewed an IPA, then brewed a porter. Sort of thought we'd do the whole color spectrum in our first four beers. And those, yeah, basically I got sort of, I learned a lesson in economics because, you know, because a week and a half later when the beer was running out and the venue was popular and people were coming back for it and everyone's saying, I love this summer ale, we had a choice of like, what do we brew again? do we brew a new beer? And I think I did. I think I brewed a Saison next, you know, to go for something a little bit more European. Then the next time the tank was empty, it's like, shit, the summer ale's about to run out. Right, well, do I try and replicate the original recipe and brew a session IPA? Well, it's outselling everything like 2-3 to 1. Like we're trying to make money. Yeah. It's a stupid thing to be.
And that's what it comes down to sometimes, doesn't it?
That's exactly what it came down to.
Pay the bills, yeah.
That's right. So basically, you know, went, you know what? I'm going to brew it again. I'm going to try this time around, obviously, to nail what it is and make it better. So rather than, you know, basically using the original recipe and fucking it up again, it was basically target the beer that I'd made. It was flawed, so it was kind of, you know, how could we tighten this up and make it a great example of itself? So it sort of became about brewing it properly and tightening up all the parameters so that it sort of hit a particular flavor profile and was just a better version of itself. And we sort of tweaked it over a couple of batches. And yeah, before I knew it, we had a core range.
and home brewers, that's the importance of measuring and detailing and taking records, isn't it? Because you can go back and repeat it.
Absolutely. And yeah,
I should listen to my own advice.
my brew spreadsheets are, you know, there's just way too much information. And that's a good thing. You know, like I just collect data for everything, and a lot of it you'll never use ever. But I tell you what, sometimes when you kind of go, is that normal? Should that be happening? Being able to look back at previous brews and know exactly what time something happened and how much of it and what, you know, what the parameters were, and being able to kind of refer to that is just invaluable. So,
mate, it's funny. You were mentioning before, we're talking about the whole brew pub model, and, you know, obviously that can really help with cash flow, and you're selling directly to your consumer, you get immediate feedback and that sort of thing. But I'm wondering whether maybe it also hinders you a little bit. I mean, you know, the majority of the beer is running through your own taps, and there are financial benefits to that. But what about outside of your own brewery? Did you ever have any problems with maybe the local pub saying, "Well, I don't want to sell that bloke's brewery because he's down the road trying to take away from my business. Why would I put a Shambles beer on tap, you know, two or three blocks away?"
Yep. In all honesty, only one. I'm happy to name and shame. It was the guy who runs Waterman's, and from the day that we walked through the door, as you know, within 2 weeks, I mean, he's got a reputation.
You know,
we walked in there, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks after being a brand new brewery. You know, I'd quit my job and use my life savings to start this thing. You know, it didn't get any less corporate than what we were. We were just people trying to make it work, and with a love of beer. We walked into a venue that we thought, you know, was supporting craft beer and had a love of beer. And that's exactly the attitude we got, you know, arms crossed, kind of, you know, why would I support you when you've got your own venue? You know, what are you going to do for me? You know, you're, you know, like all the other breweries give me discounts, you know, are you going to give me discounts? It was all about that kind of stuff. And that was literally the only time. And we walked out of there going, we'll never sell a keg to him. Like, you know, we don't even want to anymore. So that, surprisingly, no, that was the only time. And every other craft beer venue has been super supportive, and I think realized that, you know, we've got our own venue, but they don't lose anything by putting our beer on tap. Because people don't come to us instead of them. People go to all the different venues, and they, you know, we're stronger together. And I've always had that kind of mentality with all the, you know, made a real effort to reach out and be friends with all the other brewers, you know, who might otherwise see each other as competition. I think in other states there's a little bit more of a competitive edge, but I think us Tassies, we're all a little bit more of a community. Generally,
mate, I kind of know quite a few of them now around the traps, and not one of them have I heard say that you're a dickhead.
Well, that's surprising.
That's good.
I am. they're just being polite. I think we realise that the more of us there are, there was this, and I think you were one of the biggest naysayers at the start when you first started doing this podcast, kind of going, is this sustainable? There are too many breweries.
I'm happy to say I was completely wrong. Yeah.
So who's the dickhead now? You were right. Like it shouldn't really add up. You know, it's oversaturated. Tassie doesn't have the population, but I had the opposite view that we were stronger together, and the more of us there were, this whole thing of like, you know, are there too many because the craft beer is a small slice of the pie? Well, yeah, but we might be, you know, 3% of the market, but that's great because that means there's 90% sitting there waiting for us to take. That 90%, the part of the reason it's 97% of beer drinkers who are drinking mainstream beers, part of the reason why they're doing that is because they just don't like craft beers. They like what they're used to, and they like, you know, they're kind of, you know, well-made, straight down the line Aussie lagers. But the other, I think another massive chunk of that 97% just haven't been converted yet. You know, they're waiting. Now, I don't know what percentage that would be, but I think there are a lot of people in that group, and I've seen it grow. I've seen it myself. I've seen my mates who would never touch craft beer, and when we were home brewing, would kind of take the piss a little bit about our, you know, fancy wanky beer. Slowly move their way over to Fat Yak, you know. From Cascade Draft, they'd move over to James Squire Golden Ale, I'd see them bring to parties. And then they'd move over to Fat Yak, and then they'd start drinking, you know, sort of the big breweries craft beers. And now so many people I know, so many people in my circles since we've started a brewery, I see them drinking mostly independent craft beer. So that is a direct kind of thing. What's happening is people out of that 97% are becoming aware of it. They're caring more about supporting a local business. And so the more of us there are, the more aware we're making people and the more we grow our own market.
Yep. So, I had a bit of an epiphany moment when I realized that I was wrong because, you know, I've got 10 or 12 mates or whatever that we get together every now and then. And back when I used to work with Lion, I'd always shout beers because we had, you know, rations of beers to share around. And for a while after that, you know, I still had stocks of beer and whatever, and we still do it. Then one time, I don't know what it was, we were down at the shack, and you know, some of the guys would get used to just grabbing the beers out of the fridge of just whatever, because that's what I'd always done. On this occasion, I actually had a 4-pack of your summer ale in the fridge down there, and I turned around within the first hour or whatever, and they're all gone. I'm like, oh, you bastards! I bought those for me to drink, and hadn't realised. And the comments from ex Cascade Bogues draft top drinkers was like, oh, wow, what's this bloody beer? Yeah. I was like, yeah, that's a pretty new one from a local. And they're like, oh, this is awesome. And then, you know, from then on, we drank some of the other stuff in the fridge, which might have been a little bit, you know, next step, maybe an IPA or whatever. And yeah. I thought, I reckon if my mates can be converted to more flavoursome beers, I reckon there's a chance for everybody because, you know, I remember going to parties with them when we were in college and stuff, and they'd split a block of warm Harn ice, two of my best mates.
Yep, I remember
that. And yet those blokes enjoy this type of beer now. So, yeah, I'm happy to say that I'm wrong and I was wrong and I am sorry.
Well, you're not. You were slightly wrong. I think there is
still wrong.
There is a point. There's got to be a saturation point somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it definitely. You know, it's not like you can just keep adding and adding and adding breweries and they're all going to magically grow and that 97% is going to drop because, you know, well, what's happening is the reaction to that. You know, the big guys didn't care when it was 97% for them, and then it dropped to 96 and then to 95. And you know, overall beer consumption goes down, but yet within that craft beer volumes are going up, you know, year after year after year, that trend is repeated. So then we get to a point where, oh, there's heaps of us around and we're all surviving, we're all doing really well, let's just start buying them. So, you know, you see a lot of the bigger craft breweries being bought out by the bigger guys so that they can now compete properly in the craft space. You know, with authenticity as opposed to just coming up with a brand, and you know, a flavorful craft beer brewed in a brewery, they can kind of, you know, have a, you know, a pirate life where there is actually a craft brewery somewhere that they own that is churning out great craft beer. So, you know, that's what happens is you get to a point where we're doing well enough to get noticed and for them to start buying some of that market share back. And then it gets really confusing because the consumers who have been converted over, now they're drinking the right beer, but it's not, you know, it's now back in that sort of, on that sort of mega brewery kind of side, which, you know, I have no issue with that. It's, you know, it's the way of the world. But yeah, certainly there's got to be a saturation point somewhere, but it's almost self-fulfilling. Like people who might have thought of starting their own brewery, craft brewery, proper commercial one, a few years ago, you know, now that the number's up around 40, there've got to be a lot of people who might have possibly taken that pathway who, you know, who aren't taking it now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's going to be so much harder to compete.
Yeah. So being someone who's been keeping a really close eye on the market and is actually in the market operating a business, how have you seen your business change from when you opened the doors to now, you know, keeping in mind how the market's going?
We've grown over the years. I mean, we focused year one was a blur. Year one was just, you know, shit scared kind of, this could fail at any minute, you know, maybe this is just a lucky honeymoon period, and just head down, like working kind of, you know, 50, 60 hour weeks in the brew house, brewing all the beer, taking it right through production and focusing 100% on making the products as good as possible. So that was a bit of a blur and not really like keeping an eye on the business. And I know that it was working, but also not really kind of, not really ever stopping to kind of look at the numbers and go, you know, analyze it and work out where we should, like, not really casting a proper financial eye over it. Just kind of going, are we making money? Yes, good, keep going. But over time, you know, very quickly, what we realized was that the biggest impact of that crowded market that you sort of spoke of was the wholesale space. You know, yes, there really were too many of us to comfortably rely on keg sales as the way to grow and to succeed. There just aren't enough taps around that aren't owned by the big guys for us to all coexist and sell enough beer together to the craft beer bars to make money. So we very quickly worked out that wholesale kegs was a bit of a lost cause. Not that we'd ignore it, just that there was no point putting, for example, just hiring a full-time salesperson to spend 5 days a week trying to sell.
Yeah, sure.
Trying to sell kegs.
Yeah.
That was just a stupid pathway. So we went the other way. We kind of went, let the kegs sell organically to the bars that, you know, regularly take our beer. We'll knock on doors occasionally to the ones who we know will take a keg every now and again. We kind of worked out who was worth putting effort into and who wasn't. And we focused heavily on the venue side. So we, renovated our kitchen before we bought another piece of equipment for the brewery. You know, we put money into something that was nothing to do with beer.
And the food is good at your joint.
And that's the reason. It was that food was good to start with, but we had no plan for the food. We had a terrible kitchen and a really, you know, good chef who was kind of keen, but he didn't have a space to work in that could let him do what he wanted to do. And he sort of ended up moving on because of that. And so we have to put money into this. Otherwise, you know, the food side of things is going to let us down. So we renovated our kitchen and produced better food before we thought about buying anything else for the brewery. And then from there, it was basically we have to package. We have got to get into bottle shops.
Yep.
So then it was a pathway to how do we make that happen. So we started contract canning and had a plan to buy our own machine, which we did about a year ago. So that's what we've seen is sort of more awareness of our brand, more people coming through the door. And then since we started canning and being available in bottle shops, that those two things working together, more people not exist, more sales in the, you know, retail space, bottle shops and out in trade, which has led to more keg sales, more people asking for our beer in pubs that have taps, and more people coming to our venue because now they've bought it in a bottle shop or seen it in a bottle shop or seen a friend drinking it, and now they want to come and, you know, see the brewery.
Yeah.
So that's
mate, I don't want to skip over the middle couple of years, but being that we've been going 45 minutes already, it's probably good to move on to the now.
You can cut most of this out, right?
No. I'm loving the fact that you're so detailed in your. I think there's going to be people listening to this that are going to really get a lot out of this really deep dive into a story behind, you know, warts and all, what you had to do to get started. Because for those people that are out there thinking about starting a brew pub, there's some really great advice in what you're saying, but.
Has that got the most important bit of advice? Don't.
No. And, you know, I guess at the moment, no, obviously there's the C word that's changed the world, and I'm trying to avoid focusing on that.
Chris McKinnonko.
I don't want to focus on that stuff because it's, you know, I feel like, you know, in my personal life, in my job, there's just so much focus on it and I'm a bit over it.
Not too really, yeah.
Yeah, I know. But I sort of feel like it for some businesses, it's probably given them a chance to – think about their whole business model, you know, whether it be reset Absolutely. Or change something. So my first question is, are you actually still brewing at the moment?
Yes, we are. Yep.
So you are. Okay, yeah.
We are still brewing. I mean, we had, you know, when we, before this hit, we were at a point where our package sales had grown so much that we were struggling to keep up. So, you know, we went into last summer sort of, you know, knowing that we would have to brew more beer than we'd ever brewed before. We partnered with some other breweries to do the Taste of Taz. We knew we'd need a lot of beer for that. And our tanks, you know, we normally in the first 3 years, you know, come winter time, I'd have plenty of spare tanks and we could be creative and do whatever the hell we wanted. So we would brew, you know, brewed an imperial stout, a coffee stout, and, interesting beers, a sour here and whatnot there. Last winter we really kind of, you know, our tanks were clogged really early and by, you know, coming out of winter into what has traditionally for us been the quietest part of the year, which is that sort of third quarter, September, August, August, September, October kind of period.
Yep.
Particularly September, October have always been our quietest months. And that's been when we kind of prep for summer, you know, start kind of brewing batches of beer and stocking up. But suddenly having to kind of keep up with growing can sales and growing keg sales and more, you know, functions and things at our venue, we were just finding that we just didn't have free tanks. We just, the schedule was filling up and the beer was running out, you know, as quickly as we could brew it. So summer was a real kind of slog to kind of, we had to sort of stop brewing anything interesting. It was just that, you know, this is how wrong the fucking business plan was. It was all just core beers. And even on the periphery of our core range, you know, sort of this, you know, pale ale that's probably not our most popular of all the beers we make, having to kind of go, you know what, I can't fit that in. So if that runs out, it just runs out. We have to let that run out. So we came out of January kind of going, shit, we need more tanks. Like we need to expand. This is ridiculous. And we want to release, you know, this is with only two of our beers in cans. We already had plans to release the Porter and the Session IPA. And we're going, well, you know, as soon as we do that, that's going to make it even worse. So we had actually put a deposit down on six new tanks about two weeks before coronavirus really hit. Probably Australia.
Shit.
So we were in growth. We were in expand, grow, you know, let's kind of expand our capacity and really sort of hit this package sort of space. And then, yeah, sort of 2 weeks later it was, you know, oh, my God, your venue could be shut in a week. And then a week later it was. So, yeah, it really was a bit of an eye-opener in terms of how quickly things can change and how carefully you need to manage your finances when you're running a business. And luckily we'd taken our time in buying the canning machine and analyzing whether that was worth doing. We really had put a lot of effort into kind of working out what the return on investment would look like for that and, you know, kind of did our homework and then decided it was a scary decision to spend, you know, a couple of thousand more on a piece of equipment. But we did that last year and it was just, it's saving us right now because, you know, we can't sell any beers in keg. So it's the only thing we can do.
Yeah.
On top of that, you know, we were without our own machine, we were reliant on a company from Victoria coming down.
Who can't come down now.
Exactly. So we just would have been screwed. So we it turned out to be the best decision we'd ever made to buy that thing. And it's really
now you've got the three beers in cans. Have you the Session IPA hasn't hit the can yet, has it?
We're just waiting on the cans and the boxes to arrive.
You got the new design going on.
Yeah. So that
one was
part of the same sort of plan. They were all meant to be kind of ready at the same sort of time, but as things have worked out, it hasn't quite worked out that way. But it's actually probably a good thing to kind of, you know, have the two original ones part of the new design, a brand new beer, and then, you know, a month or two later, another new beer. But what we've ended up doing, we had like 100-odd kegs of beer sitting in the cool room, potentially, you know, going stale over a long period of time. But, you know, with the canning machine, we just sort of quickly went, well, let's can it. Let's just get it out of kegs and stick it in cans. So
fair enough.
Because we had that ability, we managed to kind of turn that around and empty out all our kegs and not have them.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
So that was, you know, kegs of the summer ale, kegs of the IPA, the porter, the beers we already can. Plus we've also decided, you know what, let's just chuck the amber ale and the pale ale into, this is a, you know, spoiler alert.
Silver bullets.
Let's chuck them into plain cans and get some labels for those and do them as a little limited edition. So they're coming as well.
Nice.
So that, you know, that was good to be able to adapt to that. I'm probably going to regret it because I reckon, you know, if the lockdown finishes quicker than we expect,
just turn it into a can bar.
So yeah, exactly. We're going to have to be for a little while. But yeah, we're sort of, you know, I was initially a bit scared. We paused the production of those new tanks. We kind of went, let's ride this out and see where we're going to be. But the government assistance is going to make a huge difference to everybody, including us. So that's going to help to kind of, you know, keep our cash flow going. But we're not scared anymore. We're kind of looking. We're now kind of planning for coming out of this.
Yeah, nice.
We're getting back on to, let's just get these tanks in because this is the perfect time to be, you know, while things are quiet, it's the perfect time to be building something.
Yeah.
Seems counterintuitive, but it really is. Like, you know, if you can, then you should be, this is when you should be, you know, cutting trusses and moving, you know, glycol plumbing and putting new tanks in because activity is kind of quiet. So,
hey, back on the cans for a second. I find it interesting that you're stuck with the big boy cans. Were there any thoughts about downsizing to the 375s because we're to hit a price point or because retailers are asking for it?
It's a funny one. We you know, right back at the beginning when we started canning and we were using a, you know, a different company to can our beer, we didn't have our own machine and we had the sort of choice. It really came down to, let's be true to ourselves. What do we like? And, you know, we all kind of
big cans,
like the 500 cans are just great. And we, you know, really liked what Modus were doing originally and the Balta cans and stuff. So we kind of went, you know, let's just do this and it won't matter because, you know, we're contract canning. So we'll get, you know, we're only releasing two SKUs. We'll get however many, the minimum number of cans done, which just turns out to be 50,000 of each. Made
a lot of cans.
We were like, you know what, these will last a year, and then after that, we can change our minds if we want to, and we'll kind of gather data and see how sales are going, and then we'll consider sort of the switch. And just as we released our first cans, Modus almost about the same time completely changed their entire range over to 355s.
Yeah,
one of the breweries that we'd kind of used as a bit of a example of 500 mils works changed to 375s as we'd done it. So, you know, and we just, you know, we signed up with a distributor, great local distributor out of Launceston. They're now called Sonic Syrup. They're great, great people.
G'day to Luke.
Do an amazing job. You know, initially, you know, we sort of said to them, look, we're in 500s at the moment. You guys, they were the distributors for Modus, I think still are, and Balta. Before they got bought out. So they had 500s in their range. And I sort of said, you know, what's the deal? Like, you know, Modus has now switched. Do you think that it's affected their sales? Have they gone up? And, you know, it was early days and they were sort of saying, oh, look, we really recommend you should change to 375s as soon as you can because, you know, you're going to sell more beer. So that kind of scared me off a bit, thinking, yeah, you know, when we redesign them and add more beers, we should change. But, within like a month, Ian came, you know, one of the Sonic boys came in to pick up beer and said, yep, change my mind. Stick with 500. These things are just flying and people are loving them. And one of the major comments you're getting is, oh, I love these big cans.
Yeah.
So he was sort of converted just in seeing that out in trade that they were working and that we were getting good feedback on them. And so we sort of went, you know what, for now we have no hard data whether the format makes that huge a difference.
Yep.
Whether it's positive or negative, or whether it's a bit of both, depending on who you ask, which is my gut feel, is that some people prefer one, some prefer the other, but maybe they offset each other.
Yep.
People you would pick up who would – my gut tells me that there'd be people who walk into a bottle shop, see this giant can on the shelf that stands out from other things and would pick it up. So I reckon we probably get a lot of initial sales from people being curious. And from there, the beer does the talking, right? If the beer is good, people will come back for it.
Yes. Yep.
On the flip side, there might be people who would look at it and go, that's too much beer all in one hit. I only want one sip, which is what a 375 can is. I'll avoid it. So we probably get some of that too. But the only real way to know would be to sort of simultaneously release the same beer in both formats and track your sale. Yeah. No one's going to do that. So, exactly. So for the time being, we're sort of sticking with them because I haven't sort of seen any hard and fast evidence that it will make a huge positive difference to our sales. And I really like the big fucking cans. It's just as simple as that.
I love them because they pour beautifully into this. I had this beautiful Spieglau lager glass that was just perfect for pouring in the big cans, but it bloody broke in the dishwasher the other week.
That happens.
I've got to get a replacement.
I tend to drink more of the IPA than anything else because I've, you know, always been an IPA freak. But
because it's a great beer too.
Thank you. But, you know, I tend to sort of have that in the fridge a lot, and I just find, you know, the 500 ml size for me is just the right amount in you know, in one go, if that makes sense. Not that I necessarily stop at one, but just in terms, I don't know, nowadays when I drink, you know, when I try some other beer that I'm interested in a 375, I find I'm so used to the 500s that I kind of
want a bit more.
Yeah, just 15 minutes later, it's like, oh, shit, now I have to get up again. Yeah. It's just
make great hot tub beers, the big ones.
Yeah, last longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there might be something to be said for the change, but it's certainly not happening until we've run out of the next, 200,000 of the ones we've just produced.
and of course, now you've got the porter in the cans, which formerly known as the Barry White Porter, he's now sort of a stylized image on the side of the can.
Yep.
Were you afraid that he might haunt you if you kept his name on the can? Or?
No, look, it's one of those things where you have the best of intentions sometimes, and then you start to receive negative feedback that you kind of think should be taken seriously. Really? Yeah, we just got a few comments from punters who would come in, you know, and it wasn't many. A lot of people were like, love the Barry White, you know, love that it's called Barry White. I love Barry White, that whole kind of thing. And that was literally where it came from for us. When we had those first four beers, I didn't have names picked out for them. They were just like, this one, we're saying it's a summer ale, needs a name. This is an amber ale. This is a porter. It's a robust porter. This is a thing. And we didn't have names. We were batting around names. And when you get a committee together of people who are trying to name stuff and be interesting and funny, it doesn't really work. So, you know, there were a lot of shit ideas thrown around in that for a couple of weeks. So in the end, you know, one of my best mates, who's our graphic designer, Andrew, he, you know, sort of was doing a lot of the artwork for around the venue and, you know, logo stuff and the murals on the wall. And I'd written tasting notes for the beers, you know, and I just sort of flicked into him on a whim and said, here are the tasting notes. What can you come up with? And he actually ended up naming all of our original beers.
Oh, okay.
So just simply based on the descriptions I'd given him, you know, he was like, you know, so this is easy drinking, summery kind of beer. It's, you know, great for, you know, sipping in the afternoon. He's like, afternoon delight. I'm like, that's fucking perfect. And yeah, it's same. The porter, the description was like, you know, it's smooth. It's, you know, it's sort of chocolate malty, velvety, and kind of rich and deep. And, you know, it's all those kind of. It's a baritone beer. And his mind went immediately to Barry White. That voice is just, you know, rich and deep and all that kind of stuff. And we love Barry White. Who doesn't? Like, he's just an icon. So, we, you know, like that's the perfect name for the beer. We called it Barry White. But if you don't know that story and you haven't heard it or you haven't read the tasting notes, we had
like racist undertones.
Yeah, we had people who came in and went, you know, why have you named a black beer after a black person? It's racist. And we kind of went, no, that's not the intent. It's not
political correctness.
Yeah, exactly. And look,
when I first saw that beer, that was not even entering into my mind, because in my mind is everything you just said about him being silky. Completely. Race didn't even enter my mind.
I know, but this is the thing where I get to. My personal view is there's no way that's racist. And so, you know, I kind of have this initial reaction of, you know, that's not the intent, therefore it's not racist. But then you kind of get reminded that that's not how it works. It's really not necessarily about how I take it. If some people are offended by it, then I probably have a responsibility to the people who might see it as racist. And I think it's a really minor one. Like it's not like we called a beer pussy juice. And that again was a group of people who liked to have fun, who thought they were being cheeky and funny, who overstepped and, you know, kind of took their own personal humor out into the wild and offended a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
And very quickly had to backtrack from that and learn a bit of a lesson from it. And we were getting some of these comments around the time that happened. And I'm kind of going, this could happen to us. You know, we could get enough of a backlash here that there are, you know, there's a group of people who kind of all go, we didn't realize this beer existed. And, you know, it's, you know, you're kind of missing the point. So we just made the hard decision, because I still love, you know, Barry White, to rename the beer, because we thought it was the right thing to do in case, just in case. So
You weren't worried that by having the cartoon of him on the side of the can, you might cop some similar feedback?
Not at all, because in my mind, we've done our job here. We've renamed the beer. There's no reference to him directly on the can. The image was drawn by Andrew a long time ago when the beer was named Barry White. I still love the image. I still love to know that it is Barry White to me. And I feel like I'm allowed to keep that. I'm allowed to keep the fact that I know it's Barry White internally, and the image reminds me of that. And everyone out there who might get offended, it's not called that. The image is generic. It could be anybody. There's certainly no race or color to it. It could be, you know, it could be a white guy, you know, that there's nothing. And, you know, to me, it is Barry White, but it doesn't have to be. So I don't think.
You know, at the end of the day, it's a fucking ripping beer.
Thank you.
It really is.
Important bit, isn't it? So, you know, at the end of the day, we can kind of call it what you want. And that's where eventually I got to with it. Initially, I was a bit offended that, you know, come on, you know, all this hoo-ha over a name. And eventually what I got to was, who gives a shit what it's called? It's, you know, beer's the important bit. So, you know, call it.
I really bonded with that beer early on because it was a porter, and I always feel porters get cop a bad rap for not being stouts or, you know, they're like a middle-of-the-range beer.
Drinker's mind. I love them. They're totally different, and that's the thing. Like anyone who prefers a stout over a porter again is just sort of missing the point. I think that, you know, that there's a whole spectrum of beer out there, a whole range of flavor, and, you know, nowadays you can have 50 different kinds of bloody IPA and people can argue about which one is correct and versus West and all that kind of shit. Well, you know, there's a whole range of dark beers out there, and a porter to me is entirely different to a stout, and it's, you know, it's all about that sort of smooth chocolatiness. So.
Absolutely.
And I'm the same. Like I like a stout. It's a beer that, you know, it's a great, you know, kind of robust, big kind of flavorful beer. Yeah. But at the end of the day, I can drink more porter than I can stout.
Yeah. Porter over stouts for me for sure. Absolutely. Well, mate, I better let you get back to doing your night thing tonight. It's getting close to bedtime, but to wrap this all up, mate, what are you going to expect from Shambles this summer? Is there anything new, anything different, or is it just business as usual, smashing out great beers and entertaining punters?
I honestly don't know.
It's okay.
Anyone know at the moment?
You fucked up half your other business plan, so why have a plan for this one?
Well, exactly. We had a roadmap. We had a bit of a plan about where we'd go once we had new tanks and what sorts of beers we would brew and what, you know, sort of interesting things we would do. But to be honest, you know, like with everyone else, coronavirus has thrown a bit of a tailspin. And really for us at the moment, it's about trying to sort of predict when, you know, when we might get back to operational again and sort of do everything we can to kind of plan for that. I guess partly about survival, but also, you know, the thinking ahead part is really just maybe still sticking to some plans about some interesting beers, but not anything that I would want to release publicly.
No, fair enough.
We've never really been about doing crazy shit. Like, it's never been my thing. Like, you know, I like experimenting with interesting beers, and as a home brewer, I would do it more. But really, I want to make beers that people want to drink more than once. So,
no shame in that, mate. I'm a big believer of that.
Into beers that are, you know, so crazy that you drink them and go, interesting, and never want to come back. You know, and I don't, not that there's anything wrong with those either. I like drinking those. I really do. It's so interesting. And going to Gabs, you kind of get, you know, 150 of them all at once.
Everyone needs a fridge filler though.
That's right. And I prefer that, you know, just about everything release is something that people would come back for more than one of. And so that's sort of our thing, and that's what our plan was. Yeah, more sours and things, but nothing overly.
All a good time. Crazy. Yeah. Well, mate, I want to say thanks for jumping on the podcast tonight. I apologise for not having you on sooner, but you ruined it when accepting the first invitation all that time ago for the Hop Harvest one or whatever it was, the Hop Festival one.
Yeah, yeah.
The Hop Oktoberfest. So I didn't feel like I could have you on straight away after that.
Oh, good, mate.
It's been a while, but, you know, I'm a big fan of your beers and love seeing you guys go from strength to strength.
Thanks.
Hopefully we get past all of this crap. And if you notice, we have hardly mentioned that tonight. I've loved it. We've gotten to the really great beer conversation without having to worry about,
you know, that's the important thing, isn't it? Beer.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me, but also thank you for your support. It's been kind of, you know, it's great to have people out there who are kind of fighting the good fight and getting the story out there and, you know, kind of letting us tell our story and just being supportive of the local community. It's great.
No dramas. Now, if people want to get hold of your beers from interstate, what's their best way of doing that?
At the moment, we're not doing national freight or anything like that. It's just too hard to manage. And obviously it's very expensive, but we are distributing in Victoria at the moment. So we have a guy over there who's distributing our beers, great bloke called Ian Wilson, and he's managed to get it in a whole bunch of bottle shops across Melbourne.
That'll be the Summer Ale and the Dances with Hops.
And the IPA and the Porter's just made it over there a couple of weeks ago, and the Session IPA and probably some of the seasonals will make it there in the coming weeks. So we've got a distribution list on our website. There's a locations page, and all the Victorian retailers are on there. Although cool. I That reminds me, I'll need to update that tonight.
Well, I'm getting close to 1 million subscribers now, so I'm pretty sure you'll sell out in Victoria next week. Yeah.
Wow. 1 million.
Mate, thanks for joining me tonight. It's been fantastic. Awesome. Good luck for the future. Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have an interesting beer story and want to be a guest on the Beer Healer interviews, send me a message via my Facebook page. And once again, if you want to help out the show, a simple rate and review on Apple Podcasts or a follow, like, or share on any other podcast service will do the trick. I'll catch you soon.